Road.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another fabulous show of Beyond the Cover, hosted by myself, John Roth, and Jeff Bears. Jeff, how you doing?
Doing great. How's it going?
Good. We have a very special show tonight. We are going to be talking first with author Kate Holohan on her new book, Dark Turns, and then we have a very special mystery guest coming up in the second half of the show. So you're going to have to hang around to see who that is, because we're not going to give any clues until we get them on the phone and we start talking. So you ready to roll, Jeff?
Let's do it. And, oh, I'm excited about our mystery guest, too.
Yeah, I know.
Kate's great, too. Her book's wonderful.
Yes, and so let's just jump right in. The book is Dark Turns, and here is the author, Kate Holohan. So, Kate, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm well. Thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm excited to be on.
Well, it's your debut book, and so you're kind of coming out here in a new genre, a whole new world, a bunch of stuff that we got going on. So why don't you just kind of jump right in and tell everybody about what Dark Turns is?
Oh, sure. Okay, well, I say Dark Turns is Black Swan Goes to Boarding School. My protagonist is Nia Washington. She's a young African-American ballerina who fought her way from the inner city to the stage at Lincoln Center. And when a strained foot and bitter breakup pushes her into the wings, she retreats to what should really be an easy teaching gig at an elite Connecticut boarding school to heal. But it's a thriller, so the beautiful Lakeside campus proves the worst place to launch a comeback. Shortly after she arrives on her first day, she discovers the drowned body of a young girl, and pulled into the mystery of this student's death, she becomes submerged in a world of cheating, gossip, and lies, where hyper-competitive teens will stop at nothing to hide their secrets. So, and she has to use all her talents to protect her pupils, vindicate a wrongfully accused student, and ultimately save herself. I say it's a fight to the finale, one dark turn at a time.
Why is that
my pitch? I'm sorry?
You said why ballet?
Why ballet? Well, you know, it's funny. It started when I started to get the idea from the novel. My four-year-old was taking ballet lessons. And, you know, I go in there and the teacher goes, oh, look at her. She's doing great. And she's up against a cement wall with her legs spread. And the teacher is pushing against her back to get her into a full saddle split, which is, you know, the really difficult Russian one, right? And
is that the one, and, is that the one where when guys see it, they immediately double over in pain knowing what that feels
exactly,
like?
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
And so the teacher pushes her against this cement wall and she does it, you know, and I mean, so no space, like, she does a saddle split, and my kid smiles at me, and then she starts crying because it hurts. Even for a girl, it hurts. And I thought, geez, you know, what does it do to these young girls to kind of push themselves to their physical and mental breaking points before they really have all the emotional tools to deal with that kind of competition and drive? And, you know, so I started to think about that, and it really led to a thriller. And also for me to put my kid in an easier dance class, because really, she's four, you know.
Yeah. So, I see that.
And I took ballet, though, for two years, the year that I was working on the book, and then my agent was selling it, and then I continued with it for the year that it was going back and forth with the publisher. And I have to say, I learned how to stand up straight at the end of it, but it was hard. Mm-hmm. I would walk in there, and I was feeling pretty good about myself because I, you know, had I had lost the baby weight, and I'm thinking, all right, I'm good. I'm going to, you know, go to this class, and everybody was a former dancer, and the teacher looks at me and goes, oh, I know why you're here. And I'm thinking, how does she know why I'm here? She doesn't know that I, you know, I'm researching a novel. And she pats my belly, and she goes, you're a marshmallow, but it's okay. I can make you a rock. So.
Are you freaking serious? Because that's like one of the creepiest things I think I've ever heard.
Yeah, so that was it. She said she'd make me a rock. And you know what? I won.
And that's like
I never became
creepy,
a rock.
And that still creeps me out. Yeah.
I did like to stand up straight, though.
You know, now, did you happen to put that teacher in the book somewhere?
You know, I think that the teachers in the book, they're very strict. So maybe that influenced a little bit. I ended up actually liking the teacher. I think once she got over the fact that I wasn't going to be a ballerina in my 30s, she kind of started to take it easier on me and, you know,
gotcha.
Just work on getting me to, you know, lose maybe the marshmallow, as she called it.
Well, let's jump into to Nia Washington here, and let's get into who she is as kind of a person. Like, if she was on with us and we were to interview her and talk with her, you know, who are the readers going to find out about from page one to the last page? What are they going to know about Nia? What are the things that, you know, or that you want them to kind of know about who she is?
Yeah, well, I think the thing for Nia is that she's an outsider into this world, and even though she knows ballet, she's coming into this elite boarding school where everybody is, you know, from a wealthy background, and they're kind of these coddled kids, and she didn't have that. So that gives her a great perspective to kind of see when things are wrong, and which helps her then solve the crime. And so I think she's, you know, she's tough, but at the same time, she has a vulnerability that she has to get over because she does feel like an outsider, and that kind of hampers her actions in the beginning. And so, you know, there's kind of that when you see something that's wrong, but you're thinking, oh, well, maybe I don't know because I'm not really of this world. And then afterwards you kind of go, well, you know, I have to stick with my guns. Like, that shouldn't be happening. And so I think that she ends up being a really strong person by the end of the book.
One of the questions I have for you is, when you were writing this, did you know who the killer was right away?
Or did you
figure it out as you went?
No, I think I did. You know, when I start books, I always have a protagonist and a central problem, and I kind of know how I'd like it to resolve. But then sometimes the plot points along the way change as the characters develop, and I realize, oh, you know, they're really not going to – so-and-so wouldn't do that at this point. I have to mix things up. I have my second book that's already done and with the publisher. It comes out in August. And it was the same kind of
standalone?
Thing. I'm sorry?
Standalone? Is it a standalone?
The second one is supposed to be the beginning of a series. So the second one is tentatively titled The Widower's Wife. Yes?
Okay. So Dark Turns will be a standalone and will not go any further than this. So now you're going to write a series?
Right. So the second
now,
one is
here,
supposed
so
to be the beginning of the series.
So why that? Why did you decide to go that route? Was there a specific reason why you just said, I want to write a series now instead of just maybe sticking with standalone books?
Well, the publishing house wanted a series. So we actually, when they bought the first book, I was talking to Matt and Dan at Crooked Lane, and they said that they were really interested in series. And so they were kind of like, so what kind of series ideas do you have? And, you know, I knew they were going to ask that. So I had been thinking about it, and they liked this one. And so that's what I pitched and sold.
Gotcha.
But yeah.
Well,
beggars can't be choosers, is that?
Crooked Lane, they are a new publisher. In fact, they just started publishing this year. Talk a bit about them and why you decided to go with them.
Well, you know, it's funny. I first met Matt Martz when he was at St. Martin's. I was at this great conference, the Algonquian Conference in New York City. And, you know, I thought that it was a great conference for an unpublished writer because you got to pitch, and I actually met my agent, Paula Mounier, at that conference. But I did pitch Matt on this book that I had that was done that he did not buy, but he seemed really smart, you know, and his reasons for not buying it made sense. It didn't conform to kind of some of the things you need to do to write a good suspense novel. And so I went back to the drawing board and wrote something, and my agent published it. And I mean, my agent pitched it, and he bought this the second book that became Dark Turns.
Is that first one ever going to see the light of day?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I feel like everyone is very nervous about seeing your trunk junk, right? they like it to stay in the trunk. And, you know, I really loved it. It had a It had the villain in it was Seven, so which is I guess where
okay.
I lost people. But I thought it was like the bad seed meets bad seed within a undocumented immigrant nanny. So she's really her hands are tied in like what she can report. And I thought I loved it, but
well,
I don't know.
I'm just gonna say that depending on the genre, Trunk Junk is perfectly fine. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm just throwing my two cents out there now, maybe just because that's just who I am. But now the funny thing is that, and it's not really funny, but, you know, you're a brand new author coming out debut, and you're coming out really with like a debut publisher. So how are you two kind of leaning on each other to kind of understand how to get through things? Because Crooked Lane is working through, is working with us at the magazine here. And they're doing some stuff. So how are you able to kind of, you know, maneuver things around? Because, you know, they're brand new too and you're brand new.
Yeah, I think it's, well, I guess, you know, the one thing about them being brand new is that they give a lot of attention that we're kind of their first school of authors. And so I've really felt blessed that they've, you know, that Matt and kind of the stable of editors they have, they're really hands-on with the books, and you get a lot of feedback, which you use to, I think, make a better novel. I mean, coming from a journalism background, I'm used to editors, so I feel like everyone needs an editor, you know? We're never as kind of brilliant as we are in our own heads, and so I think that it's been really helpful to have that, and also to have someone kind of teach you the rules of the genre, because every now and then you get somebody who writes that first book and it, you know, crosses boundaries and redefines things and hits it out of the park. But I think for a lot of people starting out, you kind of, you want to follow the rules a little bit, and then as you get, you know, better known, you can break them. But you have to show that you can write something good within the conceits of the genre first.
You say you have a background in journalism and also TV production. Is that right?
Yeah. I worked for Business Week magazine for a while, and then after that I went to CNBC. So I was one of the producers on Fast Money behind the scenes, you know, nowhere near the camera.
I do know Fast Money. I watch it sometimes in the morning, CNBC. And, of course, I'm 3 hours behind, so things are in the morning for me. You know, the stock market opens at 6:30. So yeah, so that's
right.
Kind of cool. So you had the background of having to deal with several different kinds of personalities too, and you probably have a lot of personalities that you can use for characters, I would think.
It's true. I mean, I like to when I'm using people for inspiration, combine a variety of people so it's not whole hog, like, hey, I took somebody that I used to work with that used to really needle me. You know, I try to spread around the love with characters. But yeah, you definitely, you know, before actually being a business journalist, I was a newspaper reporter, and I used to cover crime on the weekends. So you definitely meet a lot of different people in different situations, and you kind of use it to inform your reactions that characters have and how they think.
One of the things I really liked about the novel was how you opened each chapter. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about that with the I don't want to call them definitions, but vocabulary terms, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, I was actually talking to Paul about it. Originally, I had kind of one in the beginning, one in the middle, and one in the end. And Paula had said, "Well, before it sold, that you know it would be great to have an organizing principle and have it open every chapter." So, I got Ballerinas have this book. It's a giant book of definitions of the terms because so many ballet terms are in French. And so it's really defining the different motions. And then I would sit there and think about, okay, well, you know, is there a defining move in this chapter, or is there a double entendre where the word, you know, it's a French word, but it sounds like something in English that means something different. And so I had a lot of fun playing with those. You know, so I have one, I remember it was ligne, and the ligne is the line of the body, but the character in that chapter is fed a line that then later on turns out to be of, you know, not really true. And so, you know, when you give somebody a line, you're kind of just saying something of dubious value. But I did think about all of them that are there. Sometimes the meaning isn't as clear as with others.
It still was neat, though.
So now speaking of, like, the fill-in and kind of getting into that without giving anything away, of course, you know, we have to really do that. But
right.
When you were kind of conceptualizing the characters that you wanted to kind of play into this, and then you kind of had the story that you kind of wrapped around with them, what were you kind of looking for personally in yourself in a fill-in? Were you looking at somebody that would scare you if you were reading the book, or were you kind of thinking of another way when you decided to kind of figure out who would be the best bad person to, you know, be in your book?
Right. Well, I kind of wanted to do where there were some more obvious candidates for bad guys, and I didn't want it to have it be a complete red herring. So maybe the obvious people are involved somewhat, but there's maybe someone that you didn't think. And for me, it's partially I have two daughters, kind of what I'm afraid of. And one of the things I'm afraid of is, you know, that they would be preyed on by different types of people, you know, because I think that, I'm sure if I was a mother of boys, that's what I would worry about. But being a mother of girls, I worried about it in a in that specific manner. And I do think, you know, it's funny. Obviously, these stories hadn't come out when I was writing the book because you write a book so far in advance from when it's published. But, you know, there were all these stories that came out in boarding schools afterwards of, like, these rituals that the older students would have to kind of prey on the younger female students. And I think that it's funny that that all came out as, you know, the book hit shelves.
Yeah. And that's one thing that because I have two daughters too, and I always told them, and my biggest fear was if they, you know, started dating like a Packers fan, and I always said that would not be that would not be appropriate in my house. So I said you're not allowed to do that. So you can't have any Packer fans over. So I kind of have an idea of what you mean by kind of like getting scared, especially when you're writing those kinds of things. Yeah, no, maybe not in that realm, but I do know that it's difficult for some authors when they have children to write about things where children could be put in a bad situation, because then you start feeling as a parent and you start really sympathizing, you can't really get that emotion out. I don't know if that kind of comes into play with you at all when you're thinking of those things or not.
Well, it does. I think that for me, writing is therapy. It's just, you know, I don't pay for it. But it's a way to kind of work through some of my own fears and maybe, you know, or at least, you know, obsess about them. So that's where how I get them out. And hopefully it makes a better book, because I really am scared of those things. You know?
Well, actually, Packer fans are okay. It's Yankee fans that are a problem. I'm just letting you know that.
Well, there you go.
Oh,
and see, like, if I was really afraid of that, I would have, you know. There was actually that great movie, right, The Fan? Who's right? Didn't like De Niro play?
Yeah, De Niro and Snipes. That was freaky. And he was a freaky character in that one.
Yeah. True. So see, that was somebody who had a similar fear to you, and they thought, "Let me indulge it."
He did. I get scared every time.
Would you talk a bit about romance in your novel as well? Because you've got some of that going on too.
Yeah, I do. There is a love triangle in it, and I think that it's not that you never want to have like a moral that hits people over the head, but I guess one of the things I was exploring in the book was how we can be attracted to pretty packages and sometimes not be cognizant of what's on the inside, because everybody is polite and friendly overtly, but like, you know, you kind of have to dig to that deeper layer to really see the character of someone. And a lot of times if it comes in an attractive package, maybe people don't dig as deep as they should. So that's what I was kind of playing with, the romance angle there was, you know, who does she like and who is really the good guy, you know, and also sometimes, you know, good guys make mistakes, right? So when is it an acceptable mistake where you go, actually, they're really a good-hearted person, they made a reasonable error, then versus, you know, what is really a not acceptable mistake. So
I like that. One of the things that I noticed, and I don't see you talking about this much, is your book trailer that you made. You actually wrote the music, and you sing in it. And you have a beautiful voice, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I had a band.
You had a band?
Yeah. I was in a college a cappella group, the Princeton Tiger Lilies. And then after that, I still wanted to sing. And obviously, I didn't have a bunch of young women who were going to do and bow with me on underneath an arch. So I answered a Craigslist ad for a singer. And I had this moment talking about things that scare you. So, you know, I just graduated from college, and it's like this group of guys in Jersey in like their garage. And I walk up, and I'm like, okay, I'm here to answer the ad for a singer. And you have this one moment like, is this a good idea? Like, I don't know these guys at all. And and like, if this is just a random garage in Jersey at night. So hello. And they were perfectly nice guys, and I got the job, and we wrote original music for years, and we would we'd play around Greenwich Village and a lot of bars.
Cool.
And, I mean, we never had a following beyond friends of friends, and we got most of those people to come because we were first drink on us. But
it was
a lot of fun. Oh, yeah.
That's a really great creative outlet. I mean, writing music and, you know, lyrics and music together, I mean, that's a really great creative outlet to kind of also, you know, like you said, that's kind of therapy without paying for it.
Oh, definitely. And it's also, it's a great dating tool. I met my husband played guitar, and I think I sweetened the deal. I was like, hey, you can, at the time when we were dating, I was like, you can play rhythm. We can always use a rhythm guitarist in a couple songs. Like, maybe you want to come and play some rhythm guitar?
So
there you go. I can help you fulfill your rock star dreams.
And you weren't just stringing him along. That's nice.
Are you kidding me? I was trying to trap him. There you go.
That's a good one. So here's a question, because, you know, I always kind of like to ask debut novelists this question, too, just to kind of see what they're, how they feel, because this is the first time that you've really had to put yourself front and center like this, you know, kind of get yourself out talking to people like us, doing interviews and things like that. So how was the nervousness when the book finally hit? Because it was in November. And again, I want to let everybody know that we're speaking with author Kate Holohan, and you can find her at her website by going to CateHolohan.com, and the book is Dark Turns. So how were you able to kind of get those emotions a little under wrap when your book is out and then you start seeing reviews coming back and start seeing what people think about it and now having to market yourself out there? How's that dynamic been?
Yeah, well, I mean, it really just started in earnest. And to be honest, it's been a little terrifying for me. I'm not going to lie. It's
really
funny. And I do now have a different respect for everybody that I ever interviewed, and I feel like I should maybe start writing some apology notes. But anytime I was like, I gotcha in a question, I'm like, ah, that must have sucked. But it is very different, and I think that so far I've been fortunate, and a lot of the reviews have been good. But yeah, there was, you know, I mean, that first time you get someone who's like, I don't really get this book or some, you know, and you kind of, you feel like you want to call them up and be like, well, what was it? Can you talk me through it? And I am one of those people that kind of obsess about the negative sometimes. I think that's in part why I'm drawn to thrillers, because it kind of, it's written by people that have spent a lot of time obsessing about negative things. But, you know, it's been different, and it's been different. It's a different skill, definitely, than writing your book.
I mean, Jeff and I have been doing this for quite some time, and the one advice I think we could both tell you is that you're not going to please everybody and let the crazy people, don't engage them. If you see crazy people, like, writing reviews or however they're doing it, just let them go. Just let the crazies go in the corner. And a really good friend, a good friend of ours, a more better friend than Jeff's, is Kevin O'Brien. And how he kind of does this is that he goes on to Amazon, and I think it's a fabulous idea. He goes on to Amazon and he finds the worst review for his book, and he takes that person's name and he kills them in the next one. And I'm like, he's like, that's crazy.
That's awesome. Well, so, you know, and it's been great. Actually, writers have a lot of great ways to deal with it. I've been that was probably one of the best things about going to some conferences is that you get to meet other people and they make you feel sane. You know, they're like, well, I used to obsess about it, and then this is how I deal, and
yeah,
makes you feel better.
You just have to write the best book you can, and I always tell people, do not let success dictate your sales, and vice versa. Don't let sales dictate your success, because the only control you have is writing the best possible book you can, and if it sells, it sells, you know, but don't worry about any of that stuff. You just keep plugging away and let this series that you're now working on just take off. I think it's fabulous.
Yeah, I'm excited, and I'm really excited about the second book. I think I felt like the first one is great because you've had a longer time with it, and you've got to kind of really delve into, you know, take ballet for 2 years if you're going to, you know, write about ballet.
Right.
But I think that the second one, there's the confidence that comes with it, and you think, okay, well, maybe I will play with this more, and I can say things a little bit more bluntly. I can trust myself more as a writer. And so I think the second one for me was even more fun.
Looking forward to reading it.
I'll tell you, we're going to be looking forward to seeing it, so it'll be great.
Yeah, August. The Widower's Wife, out August. Yeah.
I tell you what, Kate, we want to thank you so much for coming on. The time flew by. It's already time to go.
Thank you, guys.
I know. We want to thank you so much for coming on. Hopefully you've had fun. We've had a blast. Wish you nothing
but
the best. Keep plugging away.
Thank you very much.
And let's see what we got in store for us next time. And love to have you back on if you're not too if we didn't scare you away, which we do to a lot of people.
No, it's been great. Thank you. I'm excited to hear your mystery guest.
Yeah. Well,
I have to listen.
You hang on because he just called in, so we are going to be getting to him right now. So you have a good night.
You too.
Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
You too. Take care. Bye.
Okay, everybody, we're going to take a short break, and we are going to be right back on with our mystery guest. We're not going to tell you who it is until he's on. And until that time, you can listen to this. Welcome back, everybody, here after the break. We want to thank you all for joining us, however, wherever, whenever you listen to the show. Always make sure you can go to iTunes. You can download the podcast. That way it goes right into whatever device you want to listen to it every week when the shows are over. And we will be back on 2 weeks with our next one, and then we're going to take a little break around the middle of December through the end of the year, so make sure you look for that. So our next guest is a number one New York Times bestselling author, a wonderful series that has been going on. And I don't want to give too much away on who he is, but we'll say that his latest book, they just came out November the 10th, he's 50% of it. So maybe that gives you a hint of who this is. So let's welcome him right now to the show. And here he is. So we want to thank you so much for coming on tonight. How are you doing?
I'm very good, Jeff. How are you, John?
Good.
Doing great.
Doing good. Now, and if people don't recognize the voice, because you might not, let's just say that this is none other than Lincoln Child. So, Lincoln, thanks so much for joining us and coming on. It's great that we were able to have you back on, because we know that there was some technical stuff the last time, but it's great to have you and to come on here and talk about a couple books. Crimson Shores, the latest one in the Pendergast series, book 15 now, just came out in November. And then we also want to get to your solo career, which you wrote The Forgotten Room. That book came out in May. But why don't we just jump into Crimson Shores since it's the latest one? How about that?
Okay. I'm happy to do that. I'm taking a virtual bow right now. Thank you for having me.
So why don't you give every – now, of course, you know, Pendergast series is synonymous in the thriller genre, the suspense thriller genre. But, you know, there's still some people who are still maybe finding out, and now that you're into book 15, of course, the series now has a lot of legs and a lot of stuff going on. What is going on here in Crimson Shore?
In Crimson Shore, we wanted to write a standalone novel that almost harkens back to the Sherlock Holmes stories in which Holmes would be sitting at home and there'd be a knock on the door and somebody would come and say, can you come and, you know, come and discover, you know, what happened to my uncle, or, you know, I found his leg bone on my front stoop, or, you know, anything, whatever might happen to be. And then off he'd go. And we decided to try something like that with Pendergast, who's an FBI agent, but he can sort of more or less do what he wants. And so in the first chapter of the book, a man knocks on the door and says, you know, I live in a small town in the coast of Massachusetts, and I've had my wine cellar stolen. Will you look into it for me? And Pendergast, of course, you know, says, I'm sorry. I'm afraid I don't have the time for such things. My interest is serial killing. And the man said, well, okay, you know, it's I figured that, but, you know, it's a shame. They stole everything, the Cretans. Thank God they missed the case of Chateau Aubranquillage. And Pendergast says, Chateau Aubranquillage. And it turns out that was the most famous, we made it up, but that was the most famous wine made in France, and because the vineyards were mustard gassed during World War I and totally destroyed, and so you can't get it anymore. But this guy had an old case in one corner of the cellar that the thieves missed, and so Pendergast says, on second thought, I will take the case, but my fee is a bottle of the wine. And the man didn't want to give it up, but Pendergast insisted. So Pendergast heads off for Xmas with his psychotic niece slash ward, Constance Green, to investigate. And they go down into the wine cellar, and Pendergast almost immediately pulls aside the empty wine racks and starts digging at the wall, the stone wall behind it, and taking out these pieces of stone. And he finds that the theft of wine was actually a smokescreen for what really happened, because what is behind the wine racks is a old bricked up niche, which inside are cuffs, you know, wrist cuffs, leg cuffs, and a single human bone left on the floor. And he turns back to Constance and says, you got to go back to Riverside Drive. You know, this is not a pleasure trip anymore. This is very dangerous. And that's how the book opens.
One of the things I love about this series is, besides Pendergast, because he's such a unique character, is Constance. And she's becoming such a stronger and stronger character as you go along. Could you talk a bit more about her?
Yes. We didn't really, it's hard to tell too much about her without giving things away, except that she's an unusual person. She's lived an unusually long life for her age, medically enhanced. Because of her upbringing, she's had rather a difficult time of it, and very hard, didn't want to trust anybody. She was first introduced in a book, Cabinet of Curiosities, as the ward of Enoch Ling. She's the kind of person who would prefer to stay in her study and read, but who is now ferociously protective of Pendergast. So for example, in Blue Labyrinth, she managed to take out an entire division almost of hired mercenaries and nothing but a couple of bottles of triflic acid, and destroying the botanic gardens of Brooklyn in the process. So I love her because she's original, she's unique, she's strange, she's dangerous, everything you want a woman to be, basically.
I would completely agree with that.
Yeah, I'm not arguing with that one.
And I've really pushed to have her front and center in the last couple of books. And so I'm pleased to see that people seem to think she's coming into her own as a character.
I really like her a lot. You mentioned when you first start talking about the book that this is a standalone. And I have to ask, without giving anything away, is this the start of a new trilogy? Especially with the way the book ends.
You know what? That leads to an interesting point, which is I've seen some reader reviews which say, what happens two-thirds of the way through the book? You know, all of a sudden these guys veer off in a different direction. It's like they tack this on, and because the book wasn't long enough, and that is entirely not the case. We plan from day one. This was going to be a story that had three layers going to it. And by that, I don't mean a super complicated Game of Thrones kind of book, but what I mean is you think something is going on and the mystery that Pendergast is solving is really not what's actually going on out there. There's something else going on out there, but you don't know what it is until a good way through the book. And suddenly you'll see that there's what you thought meant one thing, and a clue that meant to one place led someplace else. And so when the mystery seems to be solved, it's really just getting started. And that was what Doug and I had planned from the very first day we started plotting this. We're going to spin the reader around not once but twice, in terms of plot twists. That being said, towards the end of the book, we got the idea to reintroduce a certain character who's been absent for a while. And that was not our intent when we started the book. And he took the epilogue in a completely different direction than we intended it to go. So let me say this. The book does not require any prior knowledge of Pendergast to read and enjoy. You're right, the book ends on a cliffhanger. This is not the start of another trilogy like the two we've written before. However, there will be one more book after this that will tie up the knots as much as they can be tied up in the way we left things, it all over in disarray at the end of the epilogue of Crimson Shore.
Well, I loved it personally. I thought you had a great payoff, and then you had another great payoff. So that was really neat.
Well, thank you.
Now,
it was a lot of fun to write.
Now, the one thing I think that a lot of readers get curious about, because you two are so successful, solo careers too. So when you guys come together, I mean, the magic has just, has been happening now for 15 books with this series. Can you explain a little bit about the writing process? Is it like a Hall & Oates kind of thing where, somebody brings in a riff and kind of does some lyrics and things like that? Is it kind of the same thing where you might bring in an idea and then you go add things? Or do you guys have a set way that you kind of, mold these books together?
We don't really have a set way because our way has been evolving since our first book, Relic, where Doug, who'd had some experience as a writer, and I had had some experience as an editor, he did the bulk of the writing and I did the bulk of the editing. And then it sort of morphed to a point where we would each write like half of a book. Not like you take chapter one, I'll take chapter two. That wouldn't work at all. But Doug, you take the sequence involving the chase across, you know, Scotland, and I'll take the sequence involving, you know, the stalking in the museum, whatever might happen, so that it's a very smooth process. And then we'd always start out by outlining the book in rough draft. We don't want to set it in stone so that there's no room for any kind of organic development. And then, you know, I would, for example, write out an outline of 10 chapters for Doug, and he would write those, and then he'd do the same for me. But we have so much demands on our writing time right now with the solo books and the joint books and we've matured enough as writers. I've learned a lot from Doug's writing, rewriting him, and I hope he's learned a lot from rewriting me, that our styles have merged to the point where what happens these days is he will champion a book or I will champion a book, meaning he and I will get, let's say Blue Labyrinth, for example, the book that preceded Crimson Shore. Mm-hmm. Doug and I wrote out the outline for that together. We planned it out, but I wrote the lion's share of that book up to the final sequence in the Botanic Gardens, and that I storyboarded for him, because I storyboarded it for him. I knew just what I wanted to have happen, and so like Alfred Hitchcock, I said, okay, then Constance climbs up into the tree, and then she douses this guy with a big old horse syringe full of, you know, and he wrote the conclusion, because he's so good at action scenes. So, you know, we play to our strengths, and that's the way it really works right now, is we work very, very closely on the outlines. Then we each write either lesser or more of a book, and we constantly stop to ask the other person, you know, is this the best way to go? I'm stuck here. Where should I go with this chapter? It's time for us to brainstorm another set of chapters. And so really, you know, we're still completely involved in every word that goes on every page, but we tend to have books that one of us takes the lead on. Just like a Lennon and McCartney song, there's only a tiny number of those that are really co-written 50-50. You know, and I'm in no way comparing us to the Beatles, obviously, but it's the same kind of process here. There's always one of us who does more of the actual sitting in front of the screen typing.
That is very interesting. I love it.
Well, all you need is love, Lincoln.
Love is all you need.
Yeah, but don't... But Constance could be a man-eater. Huh? You know?
Back to Hall & Oates. I love it.
Exactly, yeah. You're riffing on all these... I got them both.
All these great pairs. Yeah. Well, hey, you know...
Yeah,
I mean,
not too late night to pick up on that.
You know, I mean, I would have to say, I mean, but when you're looking at suspense thriller books, I mean, you know, Preston and Child have got to be the best writing duo that I know of. There just isn't a better writing duo that I've ever seen in suspense thriller that's gone on this long that has done books like this. I mean, it's
well,
just quality
really kind,
every time it goes out.
You're very kind to say so. You know, it's we wouldn't write a bad book, or we wouldn't phone it in just because what's the point? You know, we're only writing because we love to do it. And, you know, if a time came that it became a job or a chore, we'd do something else. And secondly, the other writer wouldn't let, if Doug started to slack off, I'd be on him, you know, like, you know what? because it's both our names that go out on that book, you know, and the same thing with my solo books, you know, with Forgotten Room, for example. You know, it has to be, in the case of the solo books, they're almost always a subject that is near and dear to the heart of the writer. You know, for example, my first solo book, Utopia, I really wanted to write, which is being re-released as Lethal Velocity, I really wanted to do a thriller set in a theme park. You know, I thought there's so much to do here. And Doug said, "Oh, I can't stand theme parks. You know, get away from me with that stuff." So I wrote that on my own. And the point being that the solo books are things we really want to write about ourselves that are really of interest to us. And I now have a body of work of six novels, and that seventh book, when I write it, it's going to have to be a book I love and a book that I realize that, you know, I have six books that already in existence and I can't write anything that's crap because it will then, everything that's been written by me before will be affected and rearranged. You know, T.S. Eliot wrote a famous essay about that. Every new work that comes out, it affects all those that came before in a relative sort of way. And so that's a long-winded way of saying that, you know, we're never going to let the quality down intentionally, consciously.
Well, I would think that your having a job prior as an editor sort of helps you filter what works and what doesn't.
It does a lot in terms of, yeah, it does. You know, I guess it's a two-step process. In terms of plotting out what's going to work in a macro level, like on the plot, it does help a lot. And the funny thing is that when you're actually, the more books you write, the more you know what you should put on the page, what you should leave off, you know, how to make something exciting, where to break the chapter. It's like anything else. The more you do it, hopefully, you learn from your mistakes. You know, you get constructive criticism from readers and from your editor and from, you know, people like you, you know, and everybody, you know, we listen to what people have to say because that's the only way we can grow as writers. And being an editor really helped me know what not to do. You know, I read so many bad manuscripts and as well as some good ones, too. You know, it helped a lot early on, especially.
Well, you mentioned working together. You mentioned writing solo novels. I know you guys are writing two books a year, and then plus doing the solo books. How do you manage so much and juggle so much?
Well, we can't always do it. We were trying to write a Pendergast novel and a Gideon Crew, our other series character novel, a year, plus, you know, working on our solo books. It cannot be done, you know, and that's why the Gideon Crew books have slipped. The Pendergast books we're trying extremely hard to bring out one a year because that's our bread and butter, you know. Series.
That's your brand.
We love Gideon.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. We love Gideon Crew too, but he can lie fallow a bit longer than Pendergast can, it seems, or so we're told. And with the solo books, those are individual labors of love, and so I allow myself more time to really craft those and wait for the great ideas to come because I don't have a co-author to help. You know, and it takes longer as a result, and it's a lonelier process. So to answer your question, I don't know how these people who crank out two books a year, three books a year, four books a year do it. I mean, I have some ideas, but nothing I'm willing to say. We'll only do them as fast as we can and be happy with the result. And as a result, there's no Gideon Crew book this year, but there is a fantastic one coming out next year called Beyond the Ice Limit, of all things.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah, it's a sequel to The Ice Limit. We said we'd never write it. We didn't think we had to, but we finally, you know, people just asked us for so long, and we finally got the perfect idea and the perfect protagonist in Gideon Crew, and oh my God, that book is just, well, I can say that because Doug wrote the majority of the first draft, but he stretched out in the home stretch and really he pulled off something special. So I hope to talk to you again when that thing comes out. I hear what you think of that.
Uh-huh. Oh, we're gonna have to for sure. I'm curious. Does Gideon Crew and Pendergast, are they part of the same universe? You know how some authors take their different series characters and they're really part of the same universe? A lot of fantasy authors do that sort of thing. I'm wondering, are they part of the same universe?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I didn't realize anybody else did that. I thought we invented that about 15 years ago with Thunderhead, but I guess not. no, they do not, but... We wrote a couple of standalone books that were not Pendergast books very early on, like Riptide and Thunderhead. And we began to cross-pollinate those characters with the Pendergast books. And
right.
that developed into a larger metaverse. You know, Bill Smith backed the reporter and Nora Kelly, the archaeologist. There are some characters who've made cameo appearances, like Eli Glynn of the Ice Limit and Gideon's now boss. He manages to straddle a standalone book, the Pendergast series, and the Gideon series, but by and large, that isn't the case. The Pendergast books have such a large cast of characters now and so many shared adventures and so much backstory and history, we can really just, it's such a rich world to draw on. We don't need to go outside of it. And also, it seems like it would be somehow wrong, if Gideon and Pendergast were to meet, because their worlds are so different and they're such different people. And we try to write the books in very different ways. You know, Gideon books are very linear. They're fast moving. He's a younger guy. He's a bit of a scalawag, very different character than Pendergast is. And he gets himself in very different kinds of scrapes than Pendergast does. And so we're resisting the temptation to have them meet. Maybe at some point they will, but there's no plan for it right now.
Okay.
Now, I want to remind everybody here that we are speaking, of course, none other than with New York Times bestselling author, of course, half of the Preston Child. This is Lincoln Child with us right now, talking about the latest book, Crimson Shore, which is number 15 in the Pendergast series. And if you want to find out more information, you can always go to PrestonChild.com for more information about that. But for Lincoln solo work, you can go to LincolnChild.com. And I kind of want to transition a little bit into that one as the Forgotten Room, because I have a question is that when you're thinking and you're writing your solo stuff, do you kind of use that as a way to maybe do some new things with your writing that then you're like, hey, you know what, this kind of works, and maybe you use it in a Pendergast novel? Or do you not even think about that when you're writing a solo book like that?
I don't really think about that because I'm not sure if people can, when they're reading one of our joint books, let's say somebody is, just for argument's sake, has read three or four of my solo books, and they pick up a joint book, and can they tell which passage I've read and which passage Doug has read? I don't know. People say it's completely seamless, and we certainly try and make it that way. And I think our styles have grown together to some degree. But when I'm writing a solo book, I guess I tend to lapse more into my own style, which in the case of my series character, Jeremy Logan, he's what used to be known as a supernatural sleuth. Back at the turn of the century, they had a lot of thrilling stories about ghost breakers and things like that, like Humphrey Bogart, but versus, ghosts and the supernatural, as opposed to, versus, Casper Gutman. That's what I tend to write about in my solo books. I really enjoy that mix of a modern day sleuth. He's a medieval historian when he's not a enigmologist. He's out trying to figure out if there really is a Loch Ness monster or not. He uses very scientific methods as well as old books of lore and demonology and hopefully I keep the reader on edge, never knowing if there is a real grounded, terrestrial explanation of what's going on, or if it's supernatural until the very last page or almost. And so perhaps my style is a bit more in tune with the older kind of writing, but in terms of 20s and 30s styles. But even then, look at James M. Cain and how lean and spare his writing was, 70 years ago. And that's what I really strive for, is a very lean, exciting, stripped-down style where the chapters are short and it's very cinematic and visual. And I love hearing people approach me at a book signing all saying, damn you, I was up until 3 in the morning reading your book and I was tired all the next day at work. And if they are
higher
the next day.
That's the greatest compliment you could ever have.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if they are tired the next day, then I guess it means I did my job.
Yeah.
Well, I have a follow-up about the writing, because both of you in your solo work and together, you have a gift of making the abnormal normal, if that makes sense. How do
yes.
you do that?
What you do is you make sure that you do your research really carefully, and you set something up. You lay the foundation, you know, very scientifically, if it's a scientific kind of a premise, or if it's a location, you know, whether it be Santa Fe or the Badlands of Utah or New York City. You make sure you research your site, you know, just almost to a point of obsessiveness, so that the reader gets drawn in, and by the time you start introducing things that aren't quite real or a little bit outré, like, you know, brain-eating monsters from outer space, that's an exaggeration. But by the time you get to that point, the suspension of disbelief is hopefully total, because there's so much credible stuff you've laid the groundwork with that people are totally drawn in. At least that's our strategy.
It works. It's amazing.
Thank
well,
you.
I'll tell you. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, we really work really hard on getting our research right, and it helps having two people, because, you know, what Doug is not an expert at, I might be, and vice versa.
Well, I'll tell you what, Lincoln, we just ran out of time, but I could be going on for another hour, but I'm sure that, you know, that's a little too long. But I want to thank you so much for coming on, and I know, Jeff, I mean, this has been such a fabulous conversation, such great insight that, again, it's been such an honor to have you on. Thank you again so much for joining us. I can't express my gratitude any more than this.
No, the honor is mine, gentlemen. Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you to all who's listening. I appreciate your time.
Well, and can't wait to read the next book, and everybody go read Crimson Shore and read Forgotten Room, too. They're great.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Absolutely. All right. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Lincoln. Take care.
So again, everybody, there's the mystery guest, number one best-selling author, Lincoln Child. He is out with his writing companion, Douglas Preston, and their latest book is called Crimson Shore. It's available now wherever you buy books, Amazon, hardcover. It's available wherever you buy them, and it's hardcover, Kindle, Audible, Massive. It's all there. Make sure that you go and get it. And don't forget Lincoln's solo work, The Forgotten Room. We didn't get a lot of that. That is a fabulous book. I read it. I thought it was absolutely fascinating. So there we go, Jeff. Another successful show. It's been fabulous. Thanks again so much, man.
Well, it's been fun, and the time just flew. And, boy, great books and great discussions tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. So, again, everybody, we are going to cut it out now. We are going to say, you know, again, go to iTunes, do the podcast, get it straight into your, your devices so you know exactly what's going on and who we got coming up. But until next time, Jeff, it's always a pleasure.
Oh, it's fun. Thanks again.
Keep reading.